Thanks for joining us here today, Bernard. Maybe a good way to start was just to walk through your latest titles there. And historically, you've been kind of certainly the lead spokesperson within Microsoft for WebRTC, RTC related things with the industry. And I know you're chair and very active in standards, but could you just walk us through your current roles?
Well, I'm a principal architect in the Teams media organization, which it's in a group called IC3. Basically, it supports Microsoft Teams and other projects that are based on the Teams stack, such as ACS. So that's where I work.
Okay, the ACS being the new Azure Communication Service, which
Correct.
as you saw, we recently did a review on that. All right. I wanted to go through and talk a lot about the standards and standards updates. I know TPACK was relatively, happened, just I guess 2 weeks ago. Could you maybe start just bringing us up to speed on the state of WebRTC standardization? Maybe you can break it into, how the specs themselves are broken into media
Right.
capture streams and into WebRTC. Maybe you can walk us through that.
Basically, the WebRTC working group works on really three things. One is finishing WebRTC PC, peer connection, which is the number one priority. The second is a whole raft of capture-related specs, starting with media capture and streams, but also screen sharing, capture from DOM, image capture, media recording, a whole ton of capture-related things. And the third thing is really what we call WebRTC ND. WebRTC ND is really broken into two major categories. One is extensions to WebRTC PC, and the second part is what I would call standalone specifications, which are not dependent on RTC peer connection. So you could think of it as truly next-generation things that are distinct, and then there are the extensions which extend RTC peer connections, which is a separate category. And so the term ND is a little bit of a vague thing because when you talk about it, it's not always clear whether you're talking about extensions or standalone kind of things without a dependency on peer connection.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I actually want to dig into almost all those things.
Yeah.
Maybe to start, I guess, just for those who don't track the W3C process. So currently, the WebRTC, peer connection spec is a candidate recommendation. I think media capture and streams is also a candidate recommendation.
Correct.
Yeah,
Right.
could you, I guess, could you just walk the our listeners through,
Yeah.
I
So
guess,
I,
the stages, right? What come, I guess what was
well, so
before?
there's CR, candidate recommendation. Candidate recommendation is supposed to be the level at which it should be implementable, not necessarily interoperable, but implementable. Your connection and media capture and streams have been widely implemented. So we're at that first stage. Entering the last, what is hopefully the last CR of both of those, both media capture and streams and RTC peer connection. So the next,
Yeah, I guess when you say the last CR, I guess there's that implication is there could be multiple CRs or like see
well,
it's
and
not like a
also,
single phase, it's a multi-phase thing.
of course, there's a new W3C process where essentially you have live specifications, right? But let's just say the last one before we're about to file for proposed recommendation on both of those things. So PR is the stage at which you try to demonstrate both that the spec has been implemented, that everything in the spec has been implemented, and that it also passes your interoperability bar. So and right, and then there's recommendation, which is even beyond that. But so this is PR, and we're kind of amassing all of the data that you need, which in the case of peer connection, it's a lot of data because you need all of your interop tests, which consists of your WPT test results, but also potentially your Kite test results.
Yeah, and the WPT, I guess, being the WPT.FII, which is the general
Right.
kind of feature test, automated feature tests,
Right.
right? And Kite being the WebRTC specific interop tests, which are
Yeah, the
interop,
distinction also being WPT is really largely focused on a browser, potentially a server. We don't have server tests in WPT for WebRTC PCD. There are server tests for things like web transport. So basically, the way to think about it is it executes on a single browser. WPT doesn't really tell you about interop, whereas the kite tests are between a browser and potentially multiple entities, right? Another browser, conference server.
Yeah, so and that's really WebRTC-specific, like actually sending media and stuff too, right?
And so one of the things we've also been doing is we've been annotate the spec to understand the test coverage. There's, of course, the test results, but then you also want to know how much is actually covered by tests, which is there's an annotation you can see in the spec that shows you that as well. So anyway, the bottom line is we're trying to amass all of this data, all of this evidence that we are going to present to the W3C to claim that we are ready for the proposed recommendation stage. Okay. That is a very big step. And it has been, progress has been slowed by the virus. I mean, we thought we would get further along in the implementation process, but the virus has slowed everybody down. And so,
is that because people are busy doing things for their products, or is it because actually you couldn't get together as frequently? Or
well, it's upset a lot of things. For example, we had a report from Dr. Alex. The interop tests were often done in person at the ITF events. That's where the kite tests were done. Yep. We haven't been able to have an ITF. We've been trying to scramble to figure out how we can get it done without that. It's difficult without having everyone in the same place. We do have hackathons at the ITF meetings, but at least for me, it isn't quite the same in terms of the ability to organize everybody at the same place and same time, you know, if you're all over the world and you're it's 3 a.m. for you and somebody to do an interop test and they're on the other side of the world. So the virus has been quite disruptive in terms of testing. It's also been disruptive, I think, in terms of progress. I know that schedules have been pushed out, things we thought we would have done by the fall, just have not gotten done because people have been reassigned to other stuff.
Yeah.
So we're not quite where I hoped we would be for the PR, but we're going to go ahead with it anyway and hope that we do eventually get everything.
All right. We decided
that we wouldn't rip apart the spec and remove large portions of it just because we were slowed by the virus. Yeah.
Is that the sort of thing that, like, the I don't know what the approval process looks like, but if the committee makes a recommendation, is it usually accepted, or is there actually?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the virus has disrupted more than WebRTC PC. We are able to claim, for example, every feature that's in the current spec has been implemented in at least one browser. So we do have that. If it wasn't implemented in any browser, we have removed that to other specs or taken it out. So we have some implementation evidence for everything that's in WebRTC PC. There shouldn't be any more at-risk features there. So we have that, and the big question is, you know, when we get to 2 for every feature. But anyway, we've decided we're not going to rip the whole thing apart if it doesn't have 2, in the hope that because we have commitments from the various browsers to get the stuff done. It's just been delayed by the virus,
I think. Yeah, okay. Does this – well, maybe a broader question. Does this – do you think having a – your proposed recommendation being at that stage makes a real difference with the
I think
in general, or I mean, is it just kind of a formality of what's been?
Well, going on? I think it focuses the mind on testing and stability, and you know, one of the biggest challenges of WebRTC PC is just the sheer breadth of it. We learn every day just from bugs that slip through, important bugs, that our coverage is not, I think, where we'd ideally like it to be. We also learn how difficult it is to have even what I would call acceptable test coverage. There have been a bunch of recent bugs to things like multiplexing that actually had major impact on existing services through. And we didn't have tests for them. They weren't, what we see in a lot of these bugs is they're not the kind of things that get picked up by WPT. They are things that inherently you need something like a kite framework to do. We don't have we're not close to 100% test coverage in Kite. Very often it's specific because one service may use a feature and another may not. So the most recent example of that multiplexing, I won't say who it hit, but I think not every service was hit by it. So in a sense, you could argue that it's something that would have to be covered in private testing. That company should be running it. But anyway, it definitely does illustrate some of the challenges in testing. I would say overall that one of the biggest differences that I've experienced in real-time communications versus other aspects of networking is the enormous size, potential size of test matrices, right? It is to even conceive of, if I told you, Chad, that I wanted to assign you to develop, you know, get to 95% coverage. And we've learned this areas of real RTC like Next Gen 911, the sheer size of the numbers you need is just astounding.
Wow.
So I wouldn't say that we're at the stage. I think the progress of the process of going through it is helpful, but I think it's also made us appreciate the size of the challenge to really get everything covered. It's very hard.
All right. And maybe while we're on it, the WebRTC extensions, can you just clarify what I guess?
Yeah, so WebRTC,
I didn't realize that. Was, you know, I looked the other day when I came across going through the notes, and
So I mentioned in the what I would call the WebRTC NV bucket is a series of specifications that depend on RTC peer connection. WebRTC extensions is one of these. These are specifications that add functionality to WebRTC PC. And there's a number of things in there. There's, for example, there's going to be some work. It's not in there quite yet, but on RTP header extension encryption.
Okay.
That's something being worked on there. That's an example. It's a, like things that extend the model slightly. WebRTC SVC is not in the WebRTC extensions document, but I consider it an extensions. It's a scalable video coding extension to WebRTC PC. Those are the extension specs. I would consider insertable streams to be an extension to WebRTC PC, the encoded version of it.
Yeah.
These are all things that assume you have RTC per connection.
I want to go into a little more detail on a few of those. Maybe first, I mean, we can start talking about, I guess, what's next. So on the media capture and stream side, I did see the Git browser context media proposal. Can you explain that briefly, Elise?
Yeah. So that is really an extension. I consider that an extension to screen capture. Okay. So let me just overall talk about the issues with capture. A lot of the focus on capture has been on privacy and security. For example, I think we've discovered that the media capture and streams isn't really very good for privacy, because the assumption there was that you would give the application all the information on devices, whether they were selected or not, and then let it create its own picker. Well, that's a real problem for fingerprinting, because now I know everything, all the devices that are on your machine, right? Yeah. Even though you don't want to use that camera, I know it's there. So it really helps fingerprint you. And Jan Ivar has been proposing that we move to another model, which is much more similar to screen capture. In screen capture, you only get access to the capture surfaces that the user selects. So it's not like I get access to all your apps and I can see every window and then I get to decide as an application device what I want to look at. No, the user selects it. You only get access to that. That's the model that Jan Ivar is proposing for media capture and streams, where essentially it would become part of the browser. It would be a browser picker. Part of the browser Chrome app would only get access to info on the device the user selects. That is a big change, though, because it also brings into question some of the things the basics of media capture and streams. For example, what's the purpose of constraints if the user's just going to choose anyway?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I see. Okay. And then, would that imply then more specifications around the device picker?
I think what it does is we've decided that we're going to advance the existing spec more or less in the model we have, but then Jan Ivar is creating a separate spec for this new model where we'll work through all of those issues and understand it. The tricky thing here is it is a very different model. The new model, the browser print model, is very different. And the big question then is how you transition it in a way You know, eventually support the old model. You will apps in a fairly major way. People are used to the application pickers. So that's the big question, is how you transition over. It probably will take a very long time. But that's kind of the privacy and security question is the crux there. Now, for some of the other things you've mentioned, you know, we also have gained experience that potentially screen sharing can be a major security vulnerability. So, you know, is it possible, for example, to restrict greatly the things that can be shared? For example, in a lot of applications, you only want to share another browser tab, or you want to share only the tab you're on.
Yeah.
Right? Because potentially if you're sharing between tabs, that kind of blows apart the whole same origin model, right?
Well, certainly, I guess being a consultant, I feel that a lot. I get worried of, all right, I'm working on one client, and I have 60 windows open or whatever, and I'll get myself in trouble if I share the wrong thing.
In practice, we see it is very tricky. Users can make mistakes very easily. Yeah. You know, I think I become very wary of the whole idea of sharing entire screens. I think that's just invitation to disaster.
Notifications. I mean, this is like,
things are just coming up. You have no control about what's happening. So anyway, that's some of the things that people are thinking about. And I think it's I'd say a lot of the energy around capture is around those security and privacy concerns. And you know, the big issue is how do you transition from what you've got to these new, more secure models? You can't just cut people off, you know, and force them to rewrite their code overnight.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about WebRTC next version. I guess we're not calling it 2.0 because 1.0 is not done. So it's WebRTC NB still?
I think maybe it's time we think of sunsetting that whole term, because it really can refer to two potentially very different things. One is the, as I mentioned, the extensions to peer connection, the things like insertable stream media, WebRTC extensions, WebRTC SVC. Those are just things to, the way I think about that is when you take all those specs together, they first of all get WebRTC PC up to the same level of functionality as ORTC had. So you've already incorporated in WebRTC PC, you've incorporated the ORTC object model. ORTC also had advanced functionality, simulcast SVC, and now with these extensions, we've incorporated all that functionality. Plus, we have more through the end-to-end encryption, for example, that can be supported through insertable streams, right? So that's basically what you get is you fully got all of the – you've made WebRTC PC equivalent to ORTC finally with all of those extensions. The other very separate track is what I call a standalone specs. That would include things like web transport, web codecs, WebRTC ICE. These are things that are completely separate and do not depend on RTC per connection, right? So that is really a next version, next generation kind of break with the present. Still pretty early, obviously. Web transport is an origin trial. Web codecs is an origin trial.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about those.
Things are early, and the angle is very different because many of the things that you get that are part of the monolithic WebRTC PC, you now have to write yourself in WebAssembly. So it's a very, very different model of development. And there are pieces that are not there. For example, web transport is inherently client-server today. There is a peer-to-peer extension that we've written. And there was an origin trial of that a while back. But currently it's client-server, so you can't write the full range of WebRTC PC use cases with just web codecs and web transport as it exists today.
Yeah, I want to go through those a little bit more detail in just a moment too. Maybe quick before we do that, you were one of the authors of the original, you know, object RTC, RTC spec. Do you see, I guess, is most of the ORTC concept, has that been built in, would you say? I mean, I guess, you know, how do you feel having authored that and promote a lot of those concepts? Do you feel comfortable now that the stuff, you know, that the lower level controls and things that were needed, do you feel like they're there? And how would you compare, you know, where we're at today versus your vision?
So the object model is fully there in the Chromium browser. So we have almost all the objects from RTC. You have the ICE transport, the DTLS transport, the SCDV transport, the data channel. All of those objects are now in WebRTC PC in the Chromium browser. So one of the benefits of that is the level of detailed information that you get. And this is also part of reflected in the WebRTC stats. So when something goes wrong, you know a lot more about what happened because of these objects, right? So that was one aspect of RTC. The other aspect was the standalone aspect. And that is that you could take pieces of this and build your own app that could potentially be much smaller than a monolithic RTC per connection.
Yeah.
Places in which this really made a difference was, for example, when you talk about workers have not today where you can take an RTC per connection and put it in a worker thread. It's just too big an object, right? So the kind of scenarios that we were looking forward to were things like Internet of Things, just focuses on data transfer only. That's reflected in the WebRTC NV use cases. Those scenarios are there, like, for example, peer-to-peer data exchange. So the big, I would say that the other thing that's happened in WebRTC NV, which has become very important, is people have had a real focus on machine learning and access to raw media. This is something that ORTC did not provide. And in a sense, what I would say is that the Web Transport Web Codecs model is even lower level in that respect than ORTC was. ORTC didn't give you direct access to decoders and encoders. That's what you get from Web Codecs. So I think we've taken the ORTC ideas with respect to standalone, and we've taken it even lower.
Okay.
In Web Transport.
Yeah, let's make it, can you walk us through, I guess, a little bit, like what is Web Transport? Where did that come from? And that's, I mean, it's a whole nother working group, right?
Right. So there is now.
I see a lot of familiar names, I guess, in terms of the authors there with the WebRTC stuff. So
Web Transport is both an API, which is in the W3C Web Transport group, and a series of protocols, series of transports, which is in the ITF. And the protocols include Web Transport over QUIC, which has been called QUIC Transport, and also Web Transport over HTTP3 and potentially HTTP2. Okay. So the Web Transport API that's in W3C has potentially, I think, at least as of now, it's only for QUIC and HTTP3. HTTP2 is considered a failover transport, which would have a separate, potentially separate API.
So
think of it this way. It is that API is a client-server API. It's very much, and the constructors and everything, it resembles WebSockets quite a bit. In terms of the constructor, Web Transport constructor, you give it a URL and you get back a Web Transport. It is different, though, in the sense that you can create both reliable streams and datagrams. You can transport either of them over a Web Transport. And it is bidirectional in the sense that once the Web Transport is initiated by the client, but once that connection is up, the server can initiate either a unidirectional or bidirectional stream to the client, and datagrams can flow back and forth.
I guess, or kind of like having a socket.
Well, WebSockets really is only client side. You can't, WebSocket can't be initiated by server, but in Web Transport, it can.
Yeah.
And so that you have Web Transport over QUIC, which is where essentially the connection is not pooled. In Web Transport of HTTP3, it can be pooled. And that creates a whole bunch of very interesting scenarios, some of which were covered in ITF buffs. But the way to think about it is you can be doing both HTTP3 request response and Web Transport, including streams and datagrams, over the same QUIC connection. So one thing that kind of blows people's mind when you show it to them, there was a scenario that Justin Uberti put together for what was called the ripoff at ITF. But in that scenario, you had an RPC back and forth, request response of an RPC, that resulted in a stream from the server to the client. So think of it as a client saying, I want to play this movie or get into this game or get into this video conference. And then a stream, which could be potentially a reliable quick stream or potentially a flow of datagrams, comes from the server as a result of that. So that's actually begins to, I think, of Web Transport as potentially a revolutionary change to the web.
Yeah. Okay.
It is a revolutionary change to the web. I think much of that's, of course, the more complex version, which is the pooled HTTP3 transport. The QUIC transport is a lot simpler. It's just, give me a socket and you know, I'll send stuff back and forth over it. So that's what we've gotten started with. That is in, I'd say the Web Transport API is fairly polished now, and it's just completing its origin trial, which is ending with M88. And there are a few bugs, some things that don't quite work right. But the API is relatively polished. You can write fairly sophisticated sample code. I think it's in, you know, the we've got the spec up to date with the actual code. So if you read the spec, you can actually do the stuff in the code. I'm hopefully we'll put a complete example in there very soon. And you can try it out. On the server side, there still are some quick interop issues. So I think the server that people are using is AIO Quick, the Python library. Quiche also will, you can also use Quiche as a server, but it isn't as integrated into a framework. Unfortunately, we do not have a JS server, which would be really nice, I think, to have, but we don't, and that's probably pretty far away, like 18 months or 24 months. But you do have the Python library, so you can write stuff. So that's where we are with Web Transport. Now, people often ask, like, what about the peer-to-peer version of that? We did do that back in the summer of 2019. We had an origin trial of that. And that was in the ORTC style. It didn't support WebWG streams. It was also based on the GQuick protocol, not ITF Quick. So Web Transport, with the code that's in there in Chrome, is based on WebWG streams, and it also is based on ITF Quick. So that RTC Quick Transport code was very outmoded because it was both an older API and an older protocol. And so that code has been removed from Chromium.
It's no longer there. Does that explain what happened with that? You know,
it was just old code. It was based on GQuick, and in fact, it wasn't even the latest version of GQuick. So it had its own weird little old Quiche library. Yeah. And it was an old API, so it was just kind of code sitting around there waiting to make trouble. And so it really had to be.
It's bringing it back to WebRTC. So you know, I guess the Web Transport's client server, which I guess does work for many RTC use cases, but I guess the ultra low latency peer to peer, it doesn't work there, right? So I guess is there like something like the RTC Quick Transport that's gonna
Web Transport? Basically, what we did is we have a little extension spec which is still in the ORTC CG. Which basically, think of it as it's just Web Transport, but you have it run over the ICE transport instead of over a URL. So you don't give it, to do the construction, you don't give it a URL, you give it an ICE transport.
Okay.
That's how you construct it. But everything, and there's a few little functions, like there's a start method that you add, a few little ORTC things that are basically taken from the DTLS transport that you add to do the peer-to-peer stuff. But the extension spec is only a couple of pages. It's very, very small. Like 90% of the web, 95% of the web transfer spec is exactly the same.
Okay.
So all of the create,
I guess, on the peer-to-peer side.
Yeah.
Has anyone built it out?
Well, yeah, so we haven't got a working version with the new API and the new Quick library. So the version we had, as I said, was the older API and the GQuick version. That was what was in the Chromium code base. There isn't a version with the new stuff. And one of the tricky questions, I've looked at how to implement it. One of the big questions is, this was something that was one of the features of RTC Quick Transport, was it was standalone. This is important. The way you would build it was, and there is code there in Chromium today called WebRTC ICE. And what this is, you think of the ICE transfer from WebRTC PC. This is a standalone RTC version of this. So what happens when you construct an RTC Quick Transport from an ICE transport, it is not multiplexed with your peer connection stuff. It's on a separate port. Now, we had to do that in the case of RTC Quick Transport in the old days because GQuick could not be multiplexed with RTP, RTCP, stun and turn. ITF Quick can be. So the big question would be, would developers want to essentially think of it as use Quick along with on the same port as all of their other audio and video stuff? Like, think right today in WebRTC PC, bundling is very, very popular, right? Everybody pushes everything together on the same port. think it's well over 99% of all use of WebRTC, right? And so one might think that the QUIC would have a similar demand. And if that's what we really want, they don't want to just run your RTC QUIC transfer. You don't want to construct it from a ORTC stylized transport. You want to be able to construct it from a WebRTC PCized transport.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So that's one of the big questions is this, you know, which gets a little weird because now you're saying parts of web transport depend on RTC per connection.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a big question. Is
diagrams to include in the post here? I guess that, you know,
right. So one of the big questions was if you were to do this, would you do it in the standalone way that we did the old origin trial, right? Where you just hook up this web transport to the RTC, to the WebRTC ICE that we had, right? Standalone. And that would be for scenarios where you're really doing QUIC, and don't care to do that with you. Right. So, but like media up codex transport over, right? Say, I don't want it. I'm just building a pure NV app, right? I'm going to do my own stuff all over QUIC. It's alone. I'll allocate my own ICE, WebRTC ICE ports, do my own multiplexing, leave me alone, right? Versus a scenario where you're doing RTP audio and video and you want a little QUIC data exchange, right? That's a scenario where you're not using QUIC as a transport for both media and data. You're just using it for data and you're doing the conventional,
WebRTC
CPC. So those are the kind of questions I think you'd have to answer before you went and did this. You'd have to be very clear on what your goal was. For the peer-to-peer, whether you're just trying to extend, WebRTC CPC or just build your own standalone world of media over QUIC.
Okay. I'd like to jump back, I guess, to some of current standardization or some of the harder parts, right? Like Simulcast.
Right.
It's been a hairy area, but an important one, especially now with the increase of video conferences. Everyone does Simulcast. So I guess how are things doing with Simulcast?
Well,
standards interop type.
Yeah. You know. So, it is in there. The claim is in Chromium that all codecs are supported, or at least all the codecs that are in there now. So, in theory, you should be able to do it with H.264 and VP8 and VP9. We keep finding bugs. So, one of the interesting things was that FIPPO wrote a loopback test. You know, because we were looking at this, we're saying there's the full chi test. But we had some really horrendous bugs where, for example, H.264 wasn't working. But hey, we need a simple loopback test where we can test basic operation, which is, can you send simulcast to yourself and render it? if you can't do that, things aren't great, right?
Yeah.
So finally, FIPPO did write that. There were a couple of iterations of that, the first of which only worked on plan B, but now there's a version that works on the unified plan. What was interesting about that test is that test did not pass on all browsers. And the reason it didn't pass was because the way it worked is you sent RIDs, fooled around with the STP, and received them as MIDs. So if you sent three streams, you would get the three streams back, right? But they'd each be on a different MID. And it turned out that we discovered that Firefox didn't support the MID RTP header extension.
Okay. All right.
Right. So that actually, that loopback test did not work. So one of the things we discover is whenever you write tests, you will find something that's not quite there. I'll give you another weird little example. We've been doing some work on hardware acceleration. It turns out that when you use hardware accelerators, you can get different bit streams. It doesn't just make things faster. It actually changes the codec bit stream. And then you can actually start breaking interop. So that's been in there, and you do a simulcast test, and suddenly your SFU can't handle what's coming in anymore. So what I would say is I really wish that we were able to meet in person at one of these ITF meetings, do another simulcast test like what Dr. Alex was able to do, and see where we are. Because I would say that, ultimately, the other thing to understand is if one way you would know that we were fine is if everyone was shipping unified plan. So, for example, if everyone was using unified plan with all the codecs and they were all happy then you would know that everything works. We're not anywhere near there yet. So my sense is, let me put it this way. I would say that we are feature complete. I think that's true. But we keep finding, things keep slipping through the test coverage.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that every browser has got all the features necessary to ship commercial apps. Like, for example, I think it's true that, you know, a number of commercial apps ship on multiple browsers, but I don't think there are very, very few that ship on all browsers. And that's the real test.
Same features, at least.
So I think one way to think of this, which might be a little easier than all these test results, is if you did a matrix with all the major conferencing services and all the browsers they run on and all the different modes, that would tell you, give you probably the best look at where we are, in fact. Right. So if everyone ran unified plan on every browser and supported it with simulcast and all the features, then you'd know that everything in fact works.
Yeah. So we're a ways away from simulcast, I guess. SVC, is that even where do you see scalable video coding fitting into all this?
Well, so SVC in some ways is a little bit easier than simulcast because this is in Chromium today as an experimental implementation for temporal scalability. And of course, in Plan B, there is also support for temporal scalability as well. So this is actually out there, and there are conferencing servers that support it. So this is actually, in some ways, an easier advance for most conferencing services than, for example, supporting both RID and MID. That's one of the things that we've seen a lot of work. A number of conferencing servers do support both RID and MID. I think Meduse does, Janus does. Not everyone supports RID and MID. But one of the things about SVC to understand is that in both VP8 and VP9, it's required. The decoder must support this. So there's nothing to negotiate. You just basically, if the encoder can put it out, the SFU doesn't even have to drop stuff if it doesn't want to, right? I mean, that's obviously better, but doesn't happen.
All right. How about AV1? Is AV1 come up? Is that part of standards, I guess? How do you view AV1?
Well, so AV1, the way we're looking at AV1 is the challenge is to try to figure out how to make it useful and usable before a large swath of devices can support encoding at full resolution.
Yeah, so I should explain AV1, kind of the next generation,
right?
Open source free,
right?
Codec, right.
So AV1 itself doesn't require a lot of. It doesn't require any changes to WebRTC PC per se, but as an example, AV1 supports a lot of new scalability modes, so you want that control, which is where WebRTC SVC comes in. Yeah. The other thing is that AV1 has a very, very efficient screen content coding tool, and you want to be able to turn that on. So we added something to content hints, at what we call text, a hint that basically could cause that AV1 content coder tool to be turned on.
Yeah, all right.
So that's an example of something people think of AV1 as far in the future. But the other thing is Florent has proposed a mixed codec simulcast. And the idea of this is that you could have AV1 encode at a low bit rate, for example, a lower frame rate or maybe a lower resolution, which it could be fully capable of doing, like if you wanted to do 360p or 720p or something. And you had the machine that could do it, fine. You could do that in software. You don't need hardware acceleration for that. And then at the higher resolutions, you would use another codec. So you might use VP8 or VP9, for example, at the higher resolutions. That would allow you to introduce AV1 encoding right away, right, without forcing it to be all or nothing. Like you either do all of your simulcasts, including the high-res at AV1, or you don't use it at all, right? So that through that mixed codec simulcast and through the content hints, basically, as soon as AV1 encoder and decoder gets into WebRTC PC, it could be usable right away. I think people are not thinking much about AV1, but with these extensions, little tweaks to the API, our goal is to make it usable immediately once it gets in. And we're not that far away. Right now, Dr. Alex can tell you, he's writing the test suite. We're basically and the encoder and decoder, I mean, the library's out there, so that's not particularly complicated. Neither is the RTP encapsulation particularly complex. It's very, very simple. But the trick is in what we call the dependency descriptor header extension, which is what the SFU uses to forward. Yep. That is the tricky part of it, building it to support into the conferencing server. The other part is that AV1 is inherently built to allow end-to-end encryption, which is where insertable streams comes in. So the way I think of AV1 is as a codec, it isn't actually that big a difference in terms of the model. You know, I think of it as the next in the lineage of VP8, VP9, and AV1, right? It has some H.264 kind of malunit semantics. So it's a little bit like a cross between H.264 and VP9. But from the point of view of the overall model of usage from the conferencing server, it's very because you have this end-to-end encryption. You are not supposed to, for example, parse the AV1 OBUs, right? The SFU should be making a forward decision purely based on the dependency descriptor to allow for end-to-end encryption. So that essentially you've brought yourself to the next model where potentially an SFU can now be codec independent.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's probably a good point for the next topic is insertable streams,
right?
And I think it's been around for a little while, but been very prominent recently just because of concerns around end-to-end encryption. So I guess maybe can you comment, I guess, on, you know, where does insertable streams fit into all this? And
one of the challenges when you try to think about why insertable streams is built as it is that end-to-end encryption is not just a simple use case. That is, there have been the insertable streams is really the idea was, and it is there. It does. It is in some ways linked to RTP, and that the insertable streams API model, a way to think about it is you get access to a frame. Right, you can do things to the frame, but you do not get access to the RTP headers or the RTP header extensions or anything like that. You are not supposed to dramatically change the size of the frame. So you can't add, for example, large amounts of metadata to it. But you're supposed to operate on the frame and then essentially give it back to the packetizer that then packetizes it into RTP and sends it out. So it's somewhat linked to RTP, but the idea of S-frame, if you think about it, there are other APIs that are being developed that also operate on the same idea of giving you a video frame. And, of course, the more prominent of these is web codecs, as well as insertable streams raw media, which is really the way to think about that is an extension to media stream track. Because insertable streams raw media does not depend on RTC peer connection, whereas insertable streams encoded media does.
Okay.
So the way to think about it is in all of these APIs, you get access to a video frame, either a raw frame or an encoded one. And you can then do things to it and then essentially give it back. And in the case of insertable streams, it gets packetized and sent over the wire. There are some tricky aspects to it. In that there are some bugs that have been filed. It works with VP8 and VP9 today. It does not work with H.264. I'm not sure it can't be made to work with it, but we have a bug that's still dealing with there. But the idea here also that's important is that we are not attempting to tell the developer how to do their encryption or what key management scheme to use. We're essentially leaving it up to the developer. In insertable streams. And that's important because a lot of the, we're developing standards for the format of the end-to-end encryption, that is S-frame.
Right? Yeah.
There's IETF standardization work to be done there. What we don't have yet is full agreement on the key management scheme.
Okay.
And one of the interesting things is that it turns out there are multiple scenarios that will probably require different key management.
Okay.
One of the cool things about S-frame that makes it, I think, potentially much more extensible is that in S-frame, you are operating on an entire frame, not on packets. And what that means is if you do a signature, you're doing it once for the entire frame, right? And if you're thinking about signing, for example, in the case of packets, it was considered infeasible to do a digital signature of each packet. For example, for a keyframe, that would imply you could be, you know, doing signatures for many, many packets.
Yeah.
Right? But for the S frame, you're only doing a signature per frame. So it actually results in a dramatic decrease in the signature overhead. So it's actually possible now to have essentially origin authentication, to know who each frame came from, which is not has not been possible in the per packet model. But anyway, I think the point is that there may be multiple scenarios for key management. So it's one thing to say you'll standardize the S frame format. I think that's everyone seems to agree that you need only one S frame format. But then for key management, you know, that's a trickier thing. So we've had discussions at TPAC about potentially building S-Frame into the browser, having a native implementation of S-Frame. We have not yet at the point where we think we could have native key management.
Okay.
That right. And that is a much trickier thing, because then, you know, the fear is you could end up with five key management schemes.
Right? Yeah.
Each of those into the browser, you know, that's a whole.
Yeah, maybe along the same lines of going deeper and allowing flexibility, web codecs.
Right. So web. The thing about web.
That's a whole other working group, or I guess where does web codecs?
Well, I'm not sure where that work is going to be done. There's certainly been interest from the media working group. Okay. I'm not sure. Right now it's in the WICG, so it's being incubated. Okay.
I should probably explain it first, like web codecs, the idea where someone could actually go write their own codec.
Well, no, actually, no. It doesn't enable that. Web codecs currently doesn't allow you to plug in your own codec. What it does is it gives you access to the codecs that are already in the browser at a low level. Okay. So essentially what you get, the way to think about it is it's similar. It has similarities to insertable streams in that you get access to a frame. So okay. You can, for example, you can get access to an encoded frame, or you can feed in a raw frame and get an encoded frame.
Okay. So it's more low level direct access to the encoder.
Right. And really the
encoder too, if you want it on the other end. But
yeah. The way to think about it is that on the decoding side, this is gives you, it is similar to what we call MSE. So if you're familiar with that API, you feed
Media Stream Extensions.
Yeah, okay. You basically feed in that API takes as input containerized media, which can include content protection, and then you essentially allows you to render it to the screen.
Okay.
Right.
And all that stuff's in the streams working group, I guess is that where?
No, MSE, I think it's in the media working group.
Media, okay, all right.
Yeah, so the way to think of it is web codecs on the decode side is similar to that, except the media is not containerized, right? So you would feed it, for example, you could feel it encode media and then get that encoded media rendered. But it wouldn't be containerized. It would be in the encoded encoded video frame, right? So they're similar in that when people ask me, how do you use these things together? As an example, if you're going to do game streaming or a movie streaming or something, you could hook up web transport to receive the encoded media, and then you could render that with MSE or you could render it with web codecs. The difference is MSE you would have to transport containerized media, and with web codecs, it would not be containerized. It would be packetized. So there's that slight difference. And in functionality with MSE, you would actually get content protection support, whereas in web codecs, at least today, you would not.
Okay.
So those are the MSE and web codecs are very similar on the decode side. Now on the encode side, that's an interesting one because if you think about it, if it's a cloud game or a movie or something coming down from the cloud, you never do encoding on the browser, only decode. So that scenario actually doesn't require web codecs to ever encode anything.
Yeah.
The encode scenario would be, for example, video upload. So if you wanted to do video upload, you can encode the video with web codecs and then send it up via web transport. And you could send it up, you could do it using a reliable stream, or you could do it with datagrams. If you do it with datagrams, you would then have to do your own retransmission and your own forward error correction. So you might choose to just, if you don't care that much about the latency control for video upload, you might just use a reliable stream.
Okay.
So that's a scenario where you use web codecs as the encoder. And I think that's that scenario, that use case is one where web codecs has a real advantage because you basically you wouldn't have to do any weird tricks like put it into Canvas or something or do
anything.
Yeah.
And do you see, I guess, is the direction to let people figure out and do that stuff on their own? Or do you think there also will be a parallel track to kind of standardize some of those mechanisms?
Well, it's a, it is a real question because in a sense, you get the freedom to do whatever you want. And that's fine if you're the only, if it, everything is in your world end to end. But as an example, today, many people want to use an open source SFU, right? And you can't just send anything you want to an open source SFU. It has expectations on what it's going to get. So, you know, I think in simple scenarios where it's just like a video upload or something, it may not matter. But certainly in something like a conferencing service, it would most certainly matter that you'd want to have a standard to know what to expect. Now, the big question is whether, you know, I have the other thing to think about is performance, because I know people have raised the possibility of trying to do a conferencing server using web transport. And I would have a lot of trepidations about that because particularly today, if you look at conferencing services, there's a huge demand for bigger and bigger galleries. Like, you know, you go to seven by seven or maybe who knows how big they will get, right? 11 by 11, who knows? There seems to be insatiable demand. The instructors want to see everybody in the class. The class could be enormous, right?
Yeah.
So, the, you know, in a scenario like that, you've got an incredible number of streams, which could potentially be HD coming in. And so in that kind of scenario, your the performance actually matters an enormous amount. And so there were real questions about whether this kind of disaggregated model where much of the code is running in WASM, whether it'll copy everything all over the place zillion times. And that's how it seems to work today. For example, in web transport, you have two copies on receive. You have a copy whenever you send anything to WASM. You know, and not everything gets offloaded to a separate thread.
I guess there's a lot of potential for just, you know, inefficient use of resources or, you know, much tougher, you know, for the browser to try to manage all those resources.
Right. So, you know, people do complain about that WebRTC is monolithic, but on the other hand, there are enormous opportunities for optimization when it's one monolithic code base, right, that doesn't have all of this JavaScript running in it, right? You can eliminate a huge number of copies that might exist in the disaggregated model.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The last topic I'd like to close off on is machine learning, and I think that feeds into, well, some of, like, maybe why you'd want to do web codecs to get quick access to some of those frames to do something with it. Maybe you could talk us through some of the discussions, I guess, that are going on in the standards around machine learning. And I know we've talked about funny hats and things like that in the past. And,
So one of the things we did when we started the discussion on WebRTC AMD was to do the AMD use cases and try to gauge what people were enthusiastic about doing. And it turned out that one of the things people were most enthusiastic about, aside from the end-to-end encryption stuff, was access to raw media, because that opened up the entire world of machine learning. So, which seems to be adding new features, you know, one after another, and you can see this in the commercial services, right? So
I guess just to clarify too. I mean, access to the raw media just for the lower latency, right? I mean, I guess in the experiment I found is like. It's hard to get this stuff to run real time when there's a lot of inherent latency in the stack. I mean, can you clarify that a little bit too? I guess, like, why do you need a raw media? Because, I mean, you could get it without the raw media.
An example is a lot of the scenarios we see involve processing done locally. So, as an example, you have capture. And you want to do things on the captured media before you send it out. So, for example, you know, a lot of the effects in Snapchat, for example, are done that way. That's what we call the funny hats, right, where you do you look at the facial position and you put a hat on it or something. But also, you the way to think about that, there's other things you can do. An enormously popular feature now is custom backgrounds, right, where you detect the background changing in some way, have dynamic backgrounds, all of that kind of stuff. Now, today, many of the other aspects of machine learning are done in the cloud. For example, typically speech transcription or translation is done in the cloud, so you send it up to the cloud. I don't know that they were that close to being able to do that natively, or let alone in a web browser. There's other all kinds of things that can be probably done locally, certainly facial position and body positioning, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the overall goal long term is to be able to do anything that you can do natively that you can also do on the web. And so that basically, it not only requires access to the raw media, but raw media in an efficient way. So, for example, in native implementations, we often see everything stay on the GPU and have all the operations done there. We're not quite there to do that. To achieve the equivalent, we would need to have capture to the GPU, for example, without a copy, then allow the machine learning operations to be done without copying it back to main memory, uploading and downloading. And so that was a topic that came up at the W3C workshop, was how to do all of that efficiently. And one of the concepts that came out was the Web Neural Network API. Previously, what you've seen is a lot of the libraries like TensorFlow using things like WebGL or WebGPU. But if you think about that, that's not an entirely efficient way to do it, because really what you're trying to do is get basic operations like matrix multiply to operate efficiently. And just giving it the web GPU or web GL operations isn't necessarily the way to do it. And so WebNN really attempts to tackle those operations at a higher level, like to have an operation for a matrix multiply or stuff like that.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
So it should be able to speed it up. But one of the key things here is all of the APIs have to work in concert so that they deliver the data to the right place where it doesn't have to be copied in another API. So as an example, you'll see Web Codex does support the idea of GPU buffers. But there are limitations because a lot of times those GPU buffers are not writable. They're read-only. Right? So, you know, that's if your goal is to do machine learning and change what's in the GPU buffer, well, you're not going to be able to do that without a copy, but maybe you try to get as much performance as you can.
Yeah. So where do you see all this going? Like I you know, one of my favorite demos recently was the NVIDIA Maxine demo. I don't know if it was a super resolution technique or it's more along the lines of a deep fake with a GAN, but essentially they lowered the bandwidth by 10, or I can't remember the exact number. I'll include it, link in the post, but some very significant amount. And essentially, if you have a good enough model of somebody's face, and you can render that face in real time, then all you really need to know is all the facial points. The amount of bandwidth you need to send those facial points is very low. And by the way, if you're just going to send all those facial points, low latency, but then you're not really talking about your traditional codec either,
right?
Right. So, is that where things are going, or
that's one dimension of it? I think what you've seen, if you're looking at next generation codec research, an enormous amount of it is now being done with machine learning. So, just from the codec point of view, but the way I think about it is to look around you in the pandemic at what you're seeing. And what we're seeing is a convergence of entertainment with real-time conferencing. So you'll see a lot of your shows, your Saturday Night Live, right, was produced with conferencing. You'll see, I've seen theater put on with custom backgrounds, where the characters had custom backgrounds. We're even seeing some movies now incorporating conference technology. And we've seen from Microsoft Teams, we've seen what we call together mode, which is essentially taking the user info from the conferencing service and transporting this into an entirely new event that's entirely synthetic, right? The basketball players are real, but it's combining the game with the fans who are actually not really there. So you have constructed environments, AR, VR. So the way I think about it is that I see a convergence between entertainment and real-time scenarios And that is reflected in the tools. Like with Web Transport and with Codex, it's both RTC and streaming, right? There's all these scenarios are one. And the machine learning, think that machine learning can be the director. It can be the cameraman. It can be the editor. And it's kind of holding the whole thing together and doing and being every aspect of it, right, is potentially being impacted by machine learning. So I don't think of this as just a conventional medium. And I don't think we should think of any of this as just trying to do the same old conferencing stuff with new APIs. That's not very motivating for anybody, right? Just rewrite your conferencing service just using this entirely new set of stuff, right? But I think it enables a whole new set of I think of it, combined entertainment and conferencing scenarios that we can't even imagine today. But a lot of it seems to be have flavors of AR or VR in it.
Okay. All right. Super exciting. I guess, no shortage of things to do going forward. So with that, I think I kept you here for about an hour. I think we can wrap things up. Thank you so much. Any other final thoughts you want to give before we
close? Well, I think that people, the thing about this new technology is a lot of it is available in our engine trial. And a lot fewer people are active than you would think. But it's very instructive to use it and try it to put together things and see how well it works together. Because you'll find certainly a lot of weaknesses. I'm not saying all these APIs are coherent in any sense. They're not. But it'll I think give you a sense of what is possible out there and what you can do. And you know, people will be surprised at how soon this will be. Some of these technologies will be available. I mean, I would say in 2021, it's likely that a bunch of these things will actually start shipping, and you'll see. Some of this out there in commercial labs. So, you know, when people often treat it as something that's not here today, or I don't have to think about it. And I think they'll be wrong. And people who think about it that way are going to be very surprised in an unpleasant way.
Great. I'm lucky. So before we close, I should say you will be representing Edge on the browser panel at Cranky Geek, which is 2 weeks from today. Probably be a week or so from publication of this post. We'll see when it comes out. So I guess I'll have a chance to ask you some more questions there, but those will be more probably around Edge and you know where Edge fits into some of these topics we've been talking about. So thanks so much, Bernard, and I'll talk to you.
You're welcome. Okay, take care, Chad.
All right.